This isn't your average business podcast, and he's not your average host. This is the James Altucher Show.
Hold on. Before you start, I have to say, whoever that signed up on nutkitty.com, please follow me. I want more followers than James.
You deserve more followers than me, really, Jay.
I know.
Your lists are always interesting and
funny.
By the way, Robin's lists always outperform mine. Like, she gets more likes than mine. She wrote a list, the doomsday portfolio, like what stocks to buy for the end of the world. And I think those stocks have been doing pretty well.
Yeah, so, and I was there was a time when during the beta version, I can see the followers. I can see who ranked number one. And mine, Jay, it's always at the top.
Yeah, but then, that's because the only users of the site were the developers. And they
and the people you invited, your friends.
Yeah.
So you and were tricking the system.
All the developers are like from Malaysia. So they're like your neighbors from when you were growing up. So
yeah, I have to call them. Hey, can you follow me on nutpaddy.com, please? And then that's how we talk in Malaysia. But
today's idea list of the day is a topic near and dear to my heart. I've been through this many times. This is by he has a username K-I-E-R-O-N-I-U-S Rex. Kiranius Rex. And so the list is 10 problems you may face when starting a small business and how to overcome them. So again, 10 problems that small businesses face and how to overcome them. And these are from his personal experience starting a commercial aquaponics farm and a STEM learning garden consultation installation business. That's a lot of adjectives for that last business. So it's STEM learning garden. I guess you teach people how to install gardens and that's your business. So
I thought learning garden is mean how to plant stuff.
Yeah, you teach people how to
build a garden.
What's the installation though?
The installations? Oh, maybe you're right. Never mind.
I don't know. So his first point, by the way, I agree with his list, but I feel like my first business I started in the 90s. And I was so bad at business that I happened to be lucky. I was in a very hot space, which is we were building websites for companies when no companies had a website and nobody knew how to make a website then. I happened to know how and very few other people did. So I was very lucky because I made every business mistake you could make. So I think Kiranius Rex knows more about business than I did then because I had many more problems. But his first one is obviously the most important, is client acquisition. How do you get a customer? And it's a very interesting point because up until the point when a customer meets you, they're usually pretty happy with their situation, their life situation. Like, they don't know that they have a problem until they meet you and you could solve the problem and then they hire you. Otherwise, they would continue, if you never existed, they would continue doing what they did. So like, you know, when we were convincing people to build a website, we had to convince them that this was a problem that they had. And of course, we would say everybody else is making a website and eventually a huge chunk of your business might be off your website. And they would be like, no way, that's never going to happen. Because like, I mean, nobody had a website then. AmericanExpress.com we built. They didn't have a website before then. Or I said to HBO, one day more people are going to be viewing HBO over the internet than on television. And now there's a
Has the day come yet or not?
Well, you use your television to view HBO on the internet. So it's like a hybrid. So, but nobody ever believed me, but they still got nervous enough that they said, okay, I see that my competitor is building a website, so I should build a website. So, but like a friend of mine told me a great story about he had a product. It was in the cybersecurity space. Like, he protected big companies from getting invaded by what are called bots. Bots are like little viruses that sit on your computer, and then they're suddenly, like, there are millions of them, and they're suddenly activated like sleeper cells, and they, you know, create havoc and chaos after that. And almost every company is invaded by them. And his company had a way of avoiding that. So he pitched eBay, and eBay, he had a friend who was the decision maker. So he already knew the decision maker. But so the friend brought in all the developers and the developer said, oh my God, this is great. And then they brought in the finance people, and the finance people said, this software alone would save us $40 million a year.
Holy shit.
So he had all these things going for him. And did they hire his company? No, they did not hire his company because they were fine with the way they were already doing business. And they were fine losing $40 million a year because other areas of their business, they were losing $200 million a year. So they had to focus their priorities on those things. So you never, there's so many aspects to client acquisition. Not only do you have to have good sales technique and a decent product, you don't have to have the best product, you have to have a decent product, but you have to figure out, and this is my friend's theory, you have to figure out what they can't do without. You have to convince them that they basically cannot not have this, if that makes any sense. So client acquisition is very hard in general.
So what would you do?
Well, here's the thing I noticed about client acquisition. And this is talking about like B2B businesses. It's not necessarily talking about like if you have a new type of ramen noodles, how you get people to buy it. That's a different thing. This right. is like when you're trying to sell a big business on you. You really have to be their friend. You have to convince the decision maker that not only is he gaining a product or she is gaining a product that will make their business better and their personal lives better, because remember, they have a boss, so their boss has to be impressed with them for hiring you, so you have to make their lives better, but they also want a friend. They're not going to hire someone or outsource something to someone who they don't have friendly feelings towards, because they want to be able to call you and talk about things with you and not just talk business with you. They're basically more likely to hire a friend than not a friend. So I would make sure when I was, and again, I knew nothing about business, nothing about sales, but I made sure with everybody I was trying to sell my services to that they liked me and that I would, you know, be involved in their life a little bit. And sometimes I became too involved in their lives, which became a drag for me. But
you were both the developer and the salesperson, or did someone who would do that? Because no, usually it's kind of a two-person job, right?
Yeah. So I was developer, designer, salesperson, employee hirer, employee manager. When you have a small business, everybody is kind of everything. But I really was really the only salesperson and the only developer. A designer, I was. We had many designers, but it was 24 hours a day, which was another problem I had to face when starting a small business, is that I was spending literally 24 hours a day and never sleeping because I wasn't very good at delegating. So, this number one is the most important. He mentions other things like insurance, legal taxes, and some other good stuff too, like how you manage your, you know, people don't manage their cash flow. I think in a small business, people don't know where their cash flow is coming from. So we never tracked employee hours per project. We would just ask at the end of the month, do we have any cash or do we not have cash? But we didn't know which employees really generated the most cash and which clients generated the most cash. So sometimes
if you could go back, what would you change specifically for this cash flow?
I would have people track hours per project and then see, oh, this project paid us $10,000, but it only cost us $1,000, or this project paid us $100,000, but it cost us $150,000 to do. So I would track that better. And sales is an ongoing thing that you have to always figure out, like what's the best way to sell your product. And sometimes you have to change your product because you think you have a good product, and just because the whole world tells you you have a good product does not mean you have a sellable product. So that's another thing to think about, is what products actually create more, like for instance, providing service to make a website was not a good thing for me to sell. I should have instead sold software to companies to help them build a website. That would have provided a lot more value to my company, because when you provide a service, it's not as much value as providing a product, particularly a software product, which is very scalable. And then, you know, another thing that people underestimate is, in general, in a business with like 20 or 30 people at it, your employees are going to start having sex with each other. And this is a very complicated problem to face in a small business because they might be really good employees, and but now suddenly they're like, you know, depressed if it's not, if the relationship's not working out, or they get jealous, or things happen. And managing employees when once it starts to get to be more than like 5 or 6 employees, I think is a very hard thing.
You know, we're solving the problem now with the remote working.
Right.
Right. That remote work is great. Like that is like the answer to a lot of these problems.
Wait, so James, do you have anyone that cheated on their wife or a spouse when they work for you?
Yes, and I was very much against that. And I'll tell you another, when I was running a different business, when I was running a hedge fund, for a while I had a kind of hedge fund that invested in other hedge funds. I had a fund of hedge funds. I would not invest in any hedge fund if I suspected or found out that the hedge fund manager was cheating on their spouse. Because if they're going to cheat on their spouse, they're going to cheat on you. And I saw it again and again, how that proved to be true. So I wouldn't have anyone, and I tried not to have any employees who were cheating on spouses. You can't always track all of that. But
was that like part of the interview process?
Yeah, that would be great. Like now you have all sorts of rules about what you can and can't ask. I wish I could have asked about all that stuff. But now I think you're not even allowed to ask that stuff. But that's really important. You have to kind of figure that out. Is this person cheating on their spouse?
Right. What about this one? Overcompensate and overdeliver to overcome price.
Yeah, very important. And this was a rule at my first business. My first business was really the main business I had that was business to business. It was an enterprise-focused business. So I would always, I don't know what he means by overcompensate, but I would always overdeliver. And I would always overpromise and then overdeliver on my overpromise. So if someone said, can you make a website that does A and B? I would say, not only could I do that, but I could do a website that does A, B, and C, and then I would deliver a website that does A, B, C, and D. Because then you just never lose them as customers if you consistently overpromise and overdeliver. And some people say to me when I say this, some people say, don't you mean underpromise and overdeliver? And I say no, because when you're underpromising, you're lying, because it's a way to kind of set their expectations low so that you overdeliver just by doing your normal activity. But when I overpromise and overdeliver, sometimes my partners would look at me like, "Are you crazy? We can't do that by this date that you're promising." And everybody would have to work all weekend, and we'd get it done. But look, we were a small business. And when you're a small business and you have competition, that's the way you stand out. Word of mouth gets around about the people who overpromise and overdeliver.
Do you think you would get word of mouth even today, or have things changed too much?
No. Even today, if you're always overpromising and overdelivering. So for instance, whenever I've sold a business, this is a key point. Because not only when you selling a business is very difficult. And I don't like to invest, for instance, in companies where the CEO hasn't previously sold a business, because it's a skill all by itself. And when I sell a business, I always make sure I have some feature or aspect or product of my business that I haven't released yet that I release the day we're fully sold into another business, because then it keeps your buyers from having buyer's remorse, and you know, it just makes your life a lot easier when you overdeliver on your business, even on your entire business when you sell the business. So with Stock Picker, which is a site I sold, and a website which was like a social network for people who like investing, the day after I sold the business, I introduced a feature that allowed people to ask questions about stocks, and it was kind of like a Quora for stocks. And I didn't release that until after we were already within the new company. And even though it might have made the value of my business higher if I had released it earlier.
Interesting.
Yeah, and so I think that's a thing always. The other thing is when you're selling, if you overpromise, no one else is overpromising. So that's how you stand out from your competition. And then you keep the customer when you overdeliver. So now, but eventually eventually you lose the customer because you can't constantly exceed expectations. So, right. But you're going to lose. You're pretty much going to lose every customer eventually anyway. Like people just right. want to change and they want things different anyway. So you just have to, that's another problem with a small business. You just have to accept the fact that even your best customers are eventually going to go away.
So if you were to add something to this list, what would you add?
Managing employees. You have to know when to use them, when to lose them, when to fire them, you know, when to, you know, sometimes employees get what I call as, you have to be very aware of the stairwells right outside your business, because that's where the employees kind of congregate to talk about you. And so you have to be very aware of who's hanging out in the stairwells, because they get what I call the disease. The disease is they're somewhat disgruntled with either the business or the managers or the customers or whatever. And once you get the disease, it's hard to get rid of it unless you're fired, and you spread the disease to the other employees very quickly. The employee disease is very contagious. So you have to really manage your employees very well. The way I think about it is I always manage employees to surpass me. So I always assume eventually they're going to quit and start a competitor to me. And that's a good way to manage them, because A, it means their skills are going to be better than yours eventually. And so it's great to have a bunch of employees whose skills are on their way to being better than yours. And look, you just have to face the fact that eventually they're going to quit anyway at some point. And right. by managing in such a way that they're going to quit with superior skills to you, you won't get as upset when they do quit. Like I had a bunch of employees who were great, who eventually quit to start their own business. And my partners were so upset that our best employees quit, but I treated them with a lot of respect when they quit, and I referred customers to them, and they eventually referred customers to us. So, you know, if you treat people well, what goes around comes around.
Do you think you picked this employees well from the beginning, or did you manage to like groom them and teach them a lot? Do you think there's some sort of kind of nature or nurture when it comes to this?
It's both, because you could hire people who have a lot of potential, but they might not know the area. They might not know the industry. No one's going to know the industry as well as the founder or the CEO or the co-founders, because we've been neck deep in the industry. So you're always going to have to groom them to some extent, even if they were already, you know, good at what they did. But sometimes even if they just had potential and you're not giving them something super technical, like, you know, build a new, you know, pharmaceutical drug, you know, if you have to groom somewhat, but, and also they have to see how you sell things. They have to see how you manage things. You know, you want them to eventually have CEO potential. So there's always going to be some grooming, but there's a lot that's nature too, because you could avoid people who are, you know, who just put on a good interview, but they're actually really bad at follow through and responsibility. I'm really bad at follow through. So I definitely don't want to hire someone like me. So yeah, right. You have to be aware of your own weaknesses so you can hire people to, a lot of people hire people like them, but that's the biggest mistake you can make. I want to hire people the opposite of me. I can already do what I do. I want to hire people the opposite of me to some extent as well.
Do you have any trick to weed out bad people from interviews? Like something that you think it's a red flag or something like that?
To be honest, I don't. I feel this is one of my problems, which is that because I'm a salesman, I'm more focused on wanting people to like me than me deciding if I like others. And I can't get rid of that habit without maybe getting rid of my sales ability. So I'm not really the best person at, and everybody seems great to me when I interview them because I'm trying to get them to like me. I just can't, that's my instinct. And so I don't have a way to do that. So, but other people do. Like other people say, oh, you know, this person seems no good. I'm like, oh no, they seem fine to me. They seem great. Something rubs me the wrong way. Those usually the other people are right about that. I'm a poor judge of people.
Okay, then from now on, I'll make sure I'll be doing the interviews.
Yes, you do all the interviews for Notepad, and that will be fine with me. I'm zero. I don't want to say I have zero ability at it, but it took me a good 15 years at least, maybe more, before I started having a sense of, oh, this is a person I shouldn't work with. I would say
15 years. Wow.
Yeah. From let's say 1995 was the first time I hired anybody for anything. And it was maybe till 2012 or 2013 or even 2016, you know, that it took a long time before I realized, oh, this person was no good. And I still don't think I can choose that well. I have a problem with that.
Oh, so that's why you hired Jay?
Yes.
Jay is a great example, actually, of how to, first off, Jay is a full partner in the podcast. He's the producer of the podcast. He's a full partner in it. But, and that was Jay's dog, Jay. Jay's dog is fighting on Jay's behalf right now. But
because he's my guard dog now.
Yeah. But Jay, I worked for a long time because he worked for other podcast studios. And so it just got to the point where we were working together so well that he joined full time. That's a great way to bring someone on board.
Yes. Yeah, actually, I just, when my studio closed down, not me, like my boss is like, I don't want to do this anymore. And then I'm like, James, you know, I can help you manage all the studios. You know, I can be your engineer. And then James is like, yeah, sure. And then I just started working from there. But we worked so well because I remember every time in the studio, the guest is not here yet. James would just sit there and do his own thing. And I'm sit by myself, do my own thing. We never talk.
That's not totally true. We talked.
Not until when we move on to Stand Up New York, then we converse a little bit more because I was introvert, so I'm not comfortable with talking to strangers.
Yeah, and I was always preparing up until the last minute. And the other thing is, Jay, you always like come up with new ideas. So that's the over-promising and over-delivering thing. I'll tell you one more issue, or there's a million issues actually. I'll make my own list on Notepad with this. But this is an odd issue, but people don't realize how important it is to have a good landlord because let's say your landlord doesn't like you. There's lots of problems you could have. Like, you know, I'll give you one example. When I sold a business once, my landlord, it just so happened, didn't like us. And, you know, we had 10,000 square feet, so a full floor, and we had about 40 or 50 employees in there. And we couldn't really move so easily. And when you sell a business, your landlord, believe it or not, has to approve of you selling the business because the landlord's going to have a new tenant. You're no longer going to be the tenant. The company that buys you is the new tenant, and they have to approve of the switching of tenants. So this, the very first time I sold a business, I had $0 in the bank. I was totally broke, and we were selling a business. I was going to make good money, and it all hinged on me convincing the landlord, who hated us, who was trying to throw us out, to approve of this sale. And so
he asked for money?
It was hard to know what he was asking for. He worked in the garment district in New York, so he was like, you know, I don't know if you could picture what that kind of person is like, but he was a very hardcore kind of guy. And I think he, you know, this was during the internet boom, so I think he just wanted to know what company was buying us to see if they were a public stock and if he should buy it. So he wanted like inside information.
Oh, wow. I'm not trying to be offensive or whatever. Does he talk like this? Hey, Tony, what is your business doing? Does he sound like that?
A little less Italian.
Yeah, so it's not a scene out of The Godfather.
Yeah, but it was more. But picture that, like though, like the garment district in New York is very much Jewish. So picture that, like hardcore New York Jewish accent, and so that's like, that's what they were like.
It's like, yo, James, let's go get some coffee and we talk about it.
More like get the F out of here. I don't want to F. You guys have 3 days to leave. Like I don't care if you're getting bought. Like, and
oh, man.
And then you say, what are you effing stupid? You heard me. Get out of here. And and he would use harsher words than that. But
I didn't know landlords can cause such a big issues.
Yeah. Oh, there's a lot of, that's the thing about starting a business is that there's lots of things that you don't know about until they happen. And only bad things happen. Like the good things you always expect. Oh, a lot of people are going to buy my product. I'm going to make a lot of money and then sell for gazillions of dollars. You always, those things you expect. You never expect the bad things. Like, what if your industry changes? Which right. by the way, like my first business, the website development business, drastically changed because you didn't have to hire an outside company to do it once WordPress got there. You had to, you know, you never expect that you're going to arrive at a customer's office and you're not going to be able to figure out how to use their computer. Like one time, I may have told this story on the podcast before, but one time I was pitching Tupac's mom on doing a website for Tupac after he passed away. And I'm in his manager's office. His manager had an IBM PC and I had never used a PC. I had only used either Apple machines or Unix machines. And so I literally did not know how to turn on his computer. And he just laughed me out of the office. And then all the employees, this was going to be a big deal. All the employees gathered around when I got there and they, you know, everybody wanted to know what happened because that's how we were going to meet payroll. And I just said, let's just say we're going to have no problems meeting payroll. And because I ended up paying the payroll that month. So they didn't need to know the details. But, you know, there's lots of problems. I'm going to make my own list. But this guy, Kiranis Rest, he came up with a good solid list too, though, of 10 problems you may face when starting a small business and how to overcome them. And I don't know if you got how much you guys have been involved. Like, Jay, you see the startup side from my side. And, Paulo, right. I don't know how many startups you've been involved in. But I don't know, anything else you want to add to these lists?
I mean, not me, because like I heard all the stories, but like it's different than when you're experiencing it. When you're experiencing it, it's actually like, you know, like in your mind the whole time. But no, not that I have. What about you, Paulo?
Oh yeah, like you said, experiencing all the problems in real life now. Right. So
wait. What about AI? Does AI know what's up with?
Oh, yeah. Paulo, you said you asked AI this question. And by the way, for anybody listening, if we haven't already released it, we're releasing, if you start your idea list and you need artificial intelligence to fill out the rest of your ideas, we have worked with an AI engine and combined it with what we're doing with Notepad, notepd.com. And we have a really good AI engine that can finish your idea. So what did you ask the AI?
Yeah, so basically I asked it to complete the idea list that we started off with. So about this these problems. I think I sent you an email with what the AI recommended. Maybe can you read it?
Yeah, so it said, oh, this is a really good one. Don't be afraid to ask for help. So this is the AI completely wording this, right? You didn't word this at all, right? You didn't edit
it? Not at all. All 100% AI generated.
So the first one is, don't be afraid to ask for help. There are a lot of resources available to small business owners, but it can be difficult to know where to start. Don't be afraid to ask for help from friends, family, or other business owners. That is extremely valuable. Sometimes even your competitors they're like your frenemies. You could even go to them and say, what do you do in this situation? That became much more useful than I thought it would be. So there's a couple of these. We'll post this one. This is obviously a really strong one that I'm not so good at, but network, network, network. One of the best things you can do for your small business is to network with other business owners, attend events, meetups, and webinars to expand your network. So that's two of the five that the AI came up with. I'll post the rest at Notepad, but it's amazing how accurate it is. So, all right. So idea list of the day. 10 problems. By the way, this applies not just to small business owners, but any creative activity or any size business, really, or even if you're a solopreneur, like if you have your own sort of business, or even if you're an employee, because employees should be what I call entreployees. Like they should be entrepreneurs within their business to get ahead and succeed. And a lot of these suggestions apply to that. Like even the networking one, go out to lunch with the secretaries of every manager in the business. That's actually an amazing, useful, call it a hack for being an employee. So, but avoid having sex with them if you can. So,
no matter what gender or no gender.
You can't talk about, don't talk about that, Jay. You can't.
Okay.
Gender. Thanks very much. 10 problems small businesses have. Idea list of the day. Thanks, Jay and Paulo and the listeners.
Thank you.